Our 10-minute speaker is Emily from San Diego.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Emily. I envision myself standing up here and laughing, like, and getting it out of my, like, the nerves out of my system. And now that I'm here, I just kind of want to shake and cry a little bit. So, let's get started. Congratulations to the token takers. It was really great to see that. And welcome to the newcomers and the folks here for the first time. And so what I want to say is so I'll say this first. The reason that I say I'm an alcoholic before I say my name is so that I remember every time I go to a meeting why I'm at a meeting for my alcoholism, not for my ego. I was at central office on Tuesday morning doing a phone shift, which is an awesome service commitment to have, by the way. Just saying. Put a plug in for that. And on my off time, I was going around the archive looking at stuff, and there's this note that Bill W. had written, and the thing that stood out to me in it said, something about so that we can keep our pesky egos out of the way, or so that our pesky egos don't run the show. And that's really what keeps me from doing service commitments at central office, and what keeps me from wanting to go to meetings on a Saturday night when I could go home and watch Dexter in my very comfortable apartment, which I pay for with my very comfortable job, and, you know, things like that, all things that I got in the program, because when I got here, I was unemployed, unemployable. I didn't go to stores. I couldn't shop. I couldn't be around a large group of people. I was very anxious, and I isolated most of the time. So it was really glowy. And so how I got there, how I got to that place was a little bit about me. I grew up in a town about the size of this room with about this many people in it. In northwestern Pennsylvania, where there are three churches and three bars, so you decide which side of the spirit you're on. And my mother is an alcoholic, and her family is alcoholics. My dad had a head trauma, so he's the way that expressed in his life is he's very angry, and he beat everybody in the family except me, and I got to watch. I was raped and molested from the time I was 3 until the time I was 12 by different family members. And that is not why I drank. Let me be very clear about that. A woman just like me could have had the same experience living in a little tiny town, feeling super isolated, and started a nonprofit and written a book and changed people's lives. What did I do? I got drunk and re-traumatized myself all over the country. And, yep. Thanks. Thanks. And so I learned to resent very early on as a way to keep myself safe and to disconnect from the people in my life. Oh my gosh, I love that he's keeping up. I'm trying to talk fast, but from the people in my life who were not safe, my family. And from the first time I got drunk, the first time I remember a blackout, 9 years old, my brother had a keg party, and I was Josh's little sister, and I stood on that overturned couch, drunk, and thought that it was like I was on Jeopardy. Like, I was looking at everybody like they were on a TV screen, and I thought, and everybody's, look, it's Josh's little sister, and I thought, I made it. This is awesome. I feel nothing, and everybody is paying attention to me, finally, right? And, so I just did that. Like, I did a lot of isolating and wanting people to pay attention to me, which I don't know how that worked in my brain. But I left my little tiny town when I was 18. I moved to the thriving metropolis of Erie, Pennsylvania, where I proceeded by the age of 20 to be a cocaine dealer's girlfriend. And, girlfriend, in quotation marks. Because there were actually many. And none of them were super special. What they had was super special to me. And so by the age of 21, I had been, I had this experience where I got knocked sober, getting beat up by my drug dealer boyfriend. And I was like, oh my gosh, I just turned into my mother. I never wanted to be that woman that I saw her be, this woman that was like terrorized in her own home, blah, 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 blah. So I was like, I'm kicking this. I'm off this stuff. So for the next 6 months of my life, I drank box wine and smoked pot and watched Iron Man on Food Network, and I got off of cocaine. Thanks, alcohol. Changed my life. So then I pulled a bunch of geographics. I went from Erie to Boston, where I was convinced that the entire city of Boston sucked and was against me, of course. And I didn't care about other people. I cared about disconnecting and numbing and getting what I needed, which was attention. And I did that in a lot of different ways. And I did a lot of traumatizing to my psyche and my body. And I also, I did a lot of relationship damage. I didn't have any people in my life over long periods of time. Thank you. So I pulled another geographic, moved to San Francisco, and what I found in San Francisco was that in the Tenderloin, which is a particular part of town, at a particular part of, time of night, it doesn't matter what you wear, you could be called a prostitute. So even with my Nikes on and jeans in my backpack, guys were like, hey, honey. And I was like, oh, this is happening. Okay. So, and almost immediately, it's kind of funny, early in sobriety, I started going to a women's meeting in San Francisco called Lush Lounge. And there was a bar in my neighborhood called Lush Lounge where I hung out. And I made friends with all the bar flies, and I ate the bar cuisine, olives and cherries. And I told people things about myself that I didn't want to tell them, and I had connections that felt icky, and older men were offering me things that I didn't want. I just wanted their money. You know, like, I just wanted booze because I couldn't do cocaine anymore. I just wanted to numb out, and I wanted to connect, but not really. You know, there was this whole disconnection thing with me. So 4 years later, I was unemployed, unemployable, isolated. I hadn't been into a grocery store in probably at least 2 years. I went to the convenience store where they had white bread, cheese, liquor, cigarettes, and Ben and Jerry's, and that's what I ate. And I was too nervous to go into grocery stores. So anyway, I had tried unsuccessfully to commit suicide again for the third time in my life. Luckily for me, I was really poor when we grew up, and the first time I tried to commit suicide was with a butter knife. But let me tell you this, the impulse was there. The impulse to make it stop was there early on. So this last time, I reached out to a friend who had been a serious junkie and had gone into outpatient, and who I was like, you know, she's serious. Like, you go into outpatient, like, that's, you're a real alcoholic. So I had called her and I was telling her how miserable I was, and she said, maybe you should go to a meeting. And I was like, what do you do there? I said, I have real problems. I am miserable. What am I going to do at a meeting? And she said, why don't you just try it? And the interaction was more like expletive, like, go to meeting, F you, no F you, okay, I'll try it. That's what it sounded like. So I don't know. I didn't have anything else going on in my life, so I went. I went to a meeting, a 5:30 gay and lesbian young people's meeting, where at 27 I was the youngest person in the room by at least 10 years. And everybody came up to me and was like, oh, we love you. And I was like, wow, this is terrible. And I went once a week for a month. And what happened was that I picked up again. I got a letter in the mail that was like, oh, your unemployment isn't going to come anymore. And I was like, this is my solution. Let's get loaded. And I was totally miserable again. And all I knew how to do was drink and use. And that was really clear to me. But I also didn't know what else there was. And so I went back to that meeting, and there was a guy in the meeting who raised his hand. And at the meeting, he said, this is a muscle, by the way, that a lot of alcoholics don't know how to use, this arm muscle that raises itself at meetings, I tell my sponsees. And he said this. He said he was standing in the line at Safeway, and the voices in his head were so loud that he said, "Stop!" And the woman in front of him turned around and looked at him cross-eyed, and he laughed. And there were two things about that story that I thought were interesting, and the reason that I asked him to be my sponsor. One of them was that he was in a grocery store. And that the other thing was that he laughed at himself, two things that I hadn't done in many, many years. So I asked him to be my sponsor. Little did I know that he was a crack addict that had lived on the streets of San Diego and he got on a stepping stone to get sober. He'd been sober about 8 years. And for some reason, I cry at this part of my story, which I think is so interesting. I hope I never share in front of him because he'd get a really big head about it. He saved my life. Like, the gifts of sobriety that were given to him so freely in the program that he shared with me, in conjunction with my higher power, the things that saved my life. They were these things. Raise your hand at a meeting. Be of service. Work the steps. Call me every day. Go to meetings. How do those things save a hopeless alcoholic's life? I don't know. A person that had been trying to kill themselves since they were basically born, who felt invisible and was sure that there was nothing for her on this planet. Because, you know, alcoholics are extremists like that. How are those things going to fill up the God-sized hole in my gut and in my heart? 4 months sober, I was working the steps. I was calling my sponsor. I was going to meetings. Kind of. I didn't have any friends on sobriety. I didn't really have a service commitment. And what happened was that I was isolating again, and I was suicidal again because I had the same feelings that I had had when I was drinking and using. I just didn't have a solution for them. Painful. Two words, pain and full. Full of pain, this one. So I decided I was going to kill myself that night with a straight razor. On my way to the store, I thought, I might as well go to a meeting. Couldn't hurt. Go to the meeting, I sit down. The woman sitting right beside me sees me. I'm sure I'm green and pasty and like this, but I couldn't see myself. And she writes me a note and puts it on my, folds it up and puts it on my lap. And it says, Emily. First of all, she knew my name. This is Emily. Sobriety. Thanks for coming to the meeting. I'm so glad you're here. Let us love you until we can love yourself. And this part of my body where there's like a rib cage and some bones, it like cracked open. And I started doing this, crying, which I probably also hadn't done in as many years as I hadn't been in a grocery store. And I just started going to that meeting every week. This is a 10-year sober meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Mission District of San Francisco. If you're ever there, I highly recommend it. So that was really a turning point in my sobriety. So I did all the stuff that I was asked. And one of the saving graces in my life and in my sobriety has been, oh, God, I hope she never hears this either. My mother, who's a dry drunk, well, now she's using again. And one of the things that's been so helpful for me is to realize what I don't want to be like. I can come to meetings and raise my hand and say, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Emily. I can even have some service commitments, maybe go to 3 meetings a week and, I don't know, extend my hand to a newcomer at a meeting. And then I can go home at night and I can think about how everybody at work sucks and how they're all lazy and I do better work than they do, which is called taking someone else's inventory, in case you're wondering what that is. And I can be miserable and resentful in sobriety. And you know what? I might as well use. I might as well be drunk. And I've heard people say that. Like, I wish so-and-so would just... I don't want to be miserable in sobriety. And my experience has been that there have been times in my sobriety where I haven't had to be miserable. I've gone through a lot of hard things. And when I was drinking and using, I drank and used for the same reasons for 15 years. Nothing changed. In sobriety, simply by working the steps, simply by being willing, honest and open-minded, my life changes automatically. So anything that I'm going through, it changes a little bit at a time. It may not change on my schedule, but it changes. And I have to remember that, that even though I get into pain, I get out of it, which is so amazing. I had no idea that being willing to show up for a service commitment that I don't want to show up for, even though I signed up for it, is going to help keep me sober today and also get me out of myself. I go into misery so quickly. And that piece right there about Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most important pieces for me. The other most important piece of Alcoholics Anonymous for me is that part about keeping my pesky ego from running the show, which is really about my connection with my higher power, which is really, since probably the time that I was 9, that first time that I really connected through being numb, was really that God-sized hole, was really what I was looking for all along, was a connection to something bigger than myself. First I found it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I found it through Good Orderly Direction. Now I have conscious contact with a higher power of my understanding. And for that I am so super grateful. So I'm really grateful also for being here this evening, and congratulations for the newcomers. I wish you a long, slow recovery.